And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. 25 years ago today, federal tanks rolled onto the Branch Davidian compound just outside of Waco, Texas, and began inserting CS gas into the ramshackle home of the Branch Davidians there. After the FBI, these vehicles collapsed much of the building, a fire erupted, 76 corpses were dug out of the rubble, and there was, as you might imagine, a lot of concern subsequent to this, a lot of investigation. Many people still not satisfied with the response of the federal government. I wanted to spend time talking to a man that I interviewed 25 years ago during this Branch Davidian crisis, Dr. James Tabor. He's a professor of Christian origins and ancient Judaism at University of North Carolina, Charlotte. He's the author of several books, including Why Waco. He and a fellow scholar, Philip Arnold, worked with both the FBI and David Koresh and the Davidians during the 1993 Waco siege. You can follow James' work at jamestabor.com or follow him on Twitter at James D. Tabor. He, in fact, is right there in outside of Waco on the Mount Carmel properties as we speak, and he was there for the commemorative services today. James, great to talk with you again. It's been a long time.
Well, Al, I tell you, it's been 25 years, and I think I might remember your voice, believe it or not. It's funny how those things stick with us.
Isn't that something?
Good
yeah.
Good to talk to you.
Good talking with you.
Sorry it's under these sad circumstances for the people and for our country, but other than that, we should... I was going to tell you, I'm actually on the property.
Yeah.
It's all etched. Those of us that are, 30... probably 40, 50, 60 years old, remember it.
Yeah.
I had a class this semester with 80 students, and I knew this was coming up, so I just said to my 80, they're freshmen, sophomore, 20, 21-year-olds at UNC Charlotte. So I said, how many of you have heard of Waco, Texas, Branch Davidians, the fire, a cult, anything like that? And about 8 or 9 out of 80
Wow.
Had even heard of it.
Isn't that something?
But those of us old enough to remember, yeah. Maybe 10 years old and up in 1993.
Yeah, yeah.
We all have that picture etched in our mind, I think, of that building going up in flames on April 19th, just about 12 noon.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here right outside the spot, and it's 2 o'clock Central Time, so it's very close. This would have been the time 25 years ago when the fire was really kicking up and the horrors that we, it was live on television, as you remember.
I remember it well. I remember knowing the children were there.
So we had a memorial in town today. There was probably about 100 people, a lot of press.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically just, I spoke and Phil Arnold spoke and we mainly just remembered what happened. And then we read with slides of the photos of all those killed, including the BATF agents.
Yes.
I was glad to see they included them.
Yes, yes.
As so depending on your count, it's about 86 of David Koresh's followers.
Overall.
And, four of the ATF agents.
And four ATF.
They gave a little bio on each one and then rang a kind of a gong memorial. It was actually very moving. And especially, as you said, the children. There were 20 children, and 2 of them were unborn, but we count them, so 22 children.
Wow. Tell us,
so we
James.
We can explore it any way you want.
Yeah.
The property, I'll tell you now, as I'm looking out, there's the lake. And, of course, this is like amazing if you know Sandberg's poem about the grass and going to a battlefield years after, and you see the flowers and the trees and... It's like how, you've been to maybe Civil War battlefields,
right.
A lot of your listeners, and Revolutionary War, and you think, oh, it's such a beautiful place. How did all that carnage
How could this have
place?
Happened here, yeah.
And that's the feeling I'm getting right now as I talk to you. I'm looking right at where the building was, and it just looks as beautiful and serene, and there's a tree planted for every one of the 86 members of the group.
I didn't know
and
that.
And so those trees look like they're about 10 years old now. Mm-hmm. So someday they're going to be big towering trees.
And good.
They've rebuilt a little church here. It just looks like your little country church.
Yeah.
You know, Baptist, Methodist church you'd find anywhere in the rural.
Is it a Branch Davidian church?
Well, they call it the Branch. It's run by a guy who actually didn't follow David Koresh.
Okay.
In fact, that's a good place to start. See, people wonder, well, who were these people?
Right.
What were they?
Right.
And they actually started in 1935 in Waco, and they were led by a fellow named Victor Hotteff, H-O-U-T-E-F-F. He was a Seventh-day Adventist. But he broke with the Adventists because he believed that the kingdom of God that you read about in the Hebrew Bible and the prophets mm-hmm. was literally going to be on earth.
Okay.
And as you know, that's disputed among Catholics, Protestants, all branches
sure.
of Christianity. Some
mm-hmm.
people see it as more heavenly.
Right.
So he saw it as an earth, you know, the millennium, a real earthly kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just like the Adventists, they keep the Sabbath day, you know, the Jewish Sabbath.
Right.
They keep the dietary laws. So they're kind of like a Judeo-Christian group,
mm-hmm.
like you would have in the earliest phase of Christianity,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
before it became completely Gentile.
Yes.
So he was here in the 1935. So the guy that now runs the church, his name is Charles Pace. He's one of the original Davidians, but he didn't go along with the David Koresh phase of the group, which would be from the 1980s, 90s.
Okay.
Until the fire.
Okay.
So they've got, like any religion, you get breakoffs, you get different leaders.
Sure.
You know, different people coming along. And but I'll tell you what unifies them is the idea that there's a living prophet. You know, Ellen G. White was the Adventist prophet.
Right.
And that's a tradition that believes in, it's not charismatic in the sense of, you know, speaking in tongues and all that sort of thing. But the idea that in the last days, it's an apocalyptic kind of movement.
Mm-hmm.
The Adventist, Seventh-day Adventist, right?
Right.
They say the Advent is near, back to 1844. And so they believe that basically we're in the end times, and all these prophecies are going to be fulfilled. And that was back in the 30s. They had several disappointments. And then so Koresh is in a line of prophets or teachers of that Branch Davidian
okay.
movement.
And so
where they get their name is branch, the idea of the branch of David,
mm-hmm.
you know, the messianic branch, which Jesus claimed to be, you know, descendant of King David. So the idea that they're followers of the branch of David, meaning Jesus.
Okay.
They're not, I mean, they did follow Koresh as a prophet, but it got all mixed up in
sure.
the siege, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
He thought he was Jesus, and he thought he was God, which he didn't.
So. But he was part of a tradition that did look for some kind of special anointed teacher or prophet or leader.
Exactly.
Okay, so
and
that's actually, important to keep in mind because that
yeah,
creates, once that's accepted, once it's accepted you're looking for someone like that, then you're going to find somebody like that. I mean,
well, the thing is, what's really interesting to point out in terms of your audience, and particularly people from a Roman Catholic background, would be once people break from the mother church, either East or West,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Catholic Church, the history, and they go just to the Bible, usually there's been two directions people take. This is just talking descriptively from
sure,
history of religions.
Sure. That's right.
Either they take their Bible themselves and say, I'll interpret it, you know,
right.
And that's where we get these hundreds and hundreds of groups, and each one has their own interpretation. Or they do that, but they also congregate around someone like an Ellen G. White, a Joseph Smith,
mm-hmm.
You know, Christian Science, Mary Baker Eddy.
Yeah.
We've had three in our country that were major. And they say, well, we follow the Bible, but we also have the living interpretation. So it almost gets close to the Catholic doctrine, interestingly enough, of the seed of Peter being
right.
an ongoing interpretive voice out in addition to scriptures. So in a funny way, I wouldn't call Koresh the Pope
right.
of the Branch Davidians, but in a strange way, he was He was, see what I mean.
Yeah, he was the definitive teacher. I mean, the authoritative teacher. He had a special charism or special anointing. James, tell people how you got involved in this particular instance. You're a scholar of apocalyptic religion and early Christianity. How did you get involved in this?
Well, the way I got involved, you know, really I shouldn't even normally you stay in your field, and I do archaeology and history, and you know, I'm 2,000 years ago, Judaism, the Jesus movement and all of that.
Right.
And all of a sudden, February 28th, the day of the initial raid of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms on this Christian group, I heard it on television. It was a Sunday, February 28th, the same day that the World Trade Center was bombed, not 9/11, but if you remember,
yeah.
On February 28th, 93, there was a bombing in New York. Remember that?
Ramzi Youssef.
Underneath the World Trade Center that kind of shook things, but nothing to do with the Branch Davidians. But it's odd that you have this, you know, this date, the same date. And so my wife called me to the television, and David Koresh had gotten on with the media on just with a phone hookup. I think he was on KRLD in Dallas or something. And she said, you got to come to the TV. There's this crazy guy in Texas, and he's talking about all that stuff that you study. And I said, what are you talking about? And I ran in and started listening. And lo and behold, you know, he was quoting Book of Revelation and the Book of Daniel and all these prophecies that I study to understand early Christianity.
Right.
And here he was talking like, oh, we're in the end times and so forth. And I knew a little bit about the Adventists, and I knew about Sabbatarian groups, you know, that keep the seventh-day Sabbath and so forth. But the day, let's see, it was March 1st, he made a one-hour, 45-minute radio broadcast, and the FBI called it Bible Babble, and, you know, he had promised to come out if they would broadcast it and so forth. And I got a copy of that transcript. And I realized it was all mistranscribed. I'll give you my favorite example. He had said something about the Lion of the Tribe of Judah, which we all know is a reference to Jesus.
Right.
And they translated it in the transcript, the Liar of the Trial of Judah. And I said, wait a minute now.
James, hold it there. We got to take a break. We'll come back and pick it up. From the Liar of the Trial of Judas, I'm Al Cresta. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. James Tabor, professor of Christian origins and ancient Judaism at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. He's the author of Why Waco. He was, again, involved in trying to help mediate understanding between David Koresh, the Branch Davidians, and the FBI during the 1993 Waco siege. Today is the 25th anniversary of the conflagration, that just horrific fire that killed over 20 children and overall 86 Branch Davidians in the tragedy from the beginning, four ATF agents. And you heard this television or this radio broadcast and saw the transcript in which they made so many errors, the worst being instead of writing line
of the
It
really was nonsense. Yeah. And the main thing, David kept talking about the seven seals.
Yeah.
And they said in the press conference, what are these seals? They thought it was animals, like
oh sticks. My word!
You know, and you heard of the beasts of Revelation, and they were just completely mixed up. And you know, I'm not blaming them. These are, you know, the FBI by now got called in. They got called in the second day,
right?
Because the ATF had messed it up. But I didn't know the cause or anything. I didn't know anything about it. But I realized, so I called my friend Phil Arnold that you've talked to recently, and he was down in Rice University, and we both have PhDs in apocalyptic literature.
Right.
And I said, Phil, I understand this guy. I think they need some interpretation, because if you press an apocalyptic group and really kind of persecute them, like attack them and then harassment tactics, as what they call a hostage barricade situation to try to break them down. You just reinforce their faith.
Absolutely.
Because you're behaving like the very Babylon that they think is going to attack them in the end time.
Yeah.
So we volunteered our services, and we weren't accepted at first, but then we started working with Dick DeGuerin, who was Koresh's lawyer.
That's
and
right.
Jack Zimmerman mm-hmm. was another lawyer. And they started going in, and they took our material into David, and David had also, David Koresh, had heard us on the radio. And he started saying, I just want to talk to those guys.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, we're in the national news. You know, Koresh wants to talk to the theologians. And they never let us talk to him, but we sent materials in. And what we argued basically to David, and it was effective, it really was, look, David, right now you're a cult leader. You know, cult's a kind of four-letter word. You're a cult leader.
Right.
You're a child molester. You're a wife abuser. You're a polygamist. This is what we know about you. You claim to have a final revelation for humankind. Why don't you write an outline of that and then surrender and come out, and you can then have your day to, you know, every prophet wants to give a message.
That's right.
We don't know your message. We sort of appeal like that.
Sure.
And Passover was coming, so he said, after Passover, I'll make a decision. And the day after Passover, he sent out this famous letter in which he addressed his lawyer, Dick DeGuerin, and he said, I've gotten permission from God. He thought he spoke with God mm-hmm. to write this manuscript. It's going to take about 6 weeks, and it's going to give my message. And when it's delivered to Arnold and Tabor, I'll come out. So, of course, people say, well, you still don't know if he would. But I think he would have, because he also had the legal things worked out with the lawyers. And that
right.
had to do with what happened on the 28th.
And he was asking for materials, right? He was asking for writing materials, computer
exactly.
materials.
But see, the whole case was, like, if you come out, what's going to happen? Besides, let's say you get your message out, what's going to happen? And what Dick DeGuerin and Zach Zimmerman told him is, you have a case that they should not have used a dynamic entry. Right where I'm sitting right now in front of the building, not there anymore. Picture 75 men,
yeah.
fully SWAT team armed, pulling up fast in cattle car trailers, jumping out, and Koresh going to the front door and saying, don't shoot, there's women and children here.
Right.
And the fire, firing broke out, and that's what started the whole thing.
We still don't know who fired the first shot, do we?
We don't know for sure, but, you know, it could have been someone and up in one of the windows and so forth.
Sure.
But I'll tell you, if you look at the pictures, there's no windshields broken in those cars that the agents are crouched behind. There's not a lot of return fire.
Okay.
I know that's disputed, but, I mean, it would at least put holes in the cars and so forth
sure.
out front. But I'll tell you, the problem with it, Al, is that if you're serving a warrant, what was the crime? Okay, the crime was supposedly converting some AR, I think they're AR-15s, to fully automatic, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a kit that you buy.
Right.
And it's legal to do that, but you have to register it. And apparently they hadn't filled out the paperwork to register. Now, people say, well, they were stockpiling arms, but, you know, this is Texas. And it was a community of 120 people.
Right.
So I think the average Texan has 3 to 5 guns.
Yeah.
So,
and did they bargain too? I mean, they did. Didn't they do gun shows?
Yeah, that's actually their income was mainly gun shows, buying and trading guns.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a crime. I mean, we all have our views on guns, and lately in our country we've had these horrible events, and people are divided as to what to do about guns. But you still have to go by the law. So you don't drive up and assault a frame building with women and children
right.
and empty thousands of rounds of live ammunition. I mean, there were women, and like Winston, one of the guys in there, he was sitting on the side of his bed eating a piece of toast. It was Sunday morning. He was waking up and he shot through the head.
Yeah.
You know, this is just not the way to.
No.
So I feel it was unnecessary. I think the siege for 51 days should have been handled differently, and certainly the final day with the tanks.
Was David writing his commentary on the SEALs?
Absolutely, he was. And, you know, it's been doubted by, you'll hear interviews with FBI agents. There's no evidence he was writing, but he absolutely was writing. In fact, the manuscript was being typed the night before, and it did survive the fire in the pocket of Ruth Riddle, his typist. She brought it out. She gave it to us. And we've now published it.
Right.
It's actually on my website, jamestaber.com. You can find it. So he was writing, but he only finished the first seal. These seals, they're in Revelation chapter 6. When you open a seal, something happens, and it leads up to the end.
Yeah.
It's an apocalyptic kind of thing.
Sure.
So.
Well, it's so as you read this situation, the FBI could have waited this out. It didn't require the kind of forced this use of CS gas to drive them out. You think that this could have been resolved with a little more time?
I think so, and I don't think it would have been a lot of time. And the problem with them coming out, some of them are right here with me right now. I mean, they're on the grounds walking around. And I've asked them, you know, because there were 9 survivors, and 3 of them are here today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why didn't you come out? Why didn't you come out? They said, we were terrified that we would be shot.
Yeah.
You know, they were actually afraid.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of it the whole time. They didn't trust the FBI, and the FBI didn't trust them.
Right.
And there was this surrender plan, though, worked out with the lawyers. And if you listen to the tapes, see, the fire was on April 19th. I think that was a Monday morning. But even Saturday night and Sunday, the tapes are negotiations between the negotiators and David. Negotiators didn't know what the tactical people were planning. They didn't tell them because they were afraid they might tip them off.
Wow.
So negotiators are negotiating in good faith, and they're like high-fiving each other, and they're saying, David's saying things like, hey, Henry, did you eat a pizza for me? And Henry goes, yeah, and I took a shower too. And he goes, oh, I can't wait to get out. And he said, you know, I think we're going to be friends. And the people that have survived have told me they were so happy that weekend. They were packing their bags. They were telling the kids, honey, we're going out.
Yeah.
It's all worked out. You know, David's writing his thing. And so I believe that it was in their interest to come out.
Yes.
Because nobody wants to die. And I know everybody says they committed suicide. They were against suicide. They
right.
thought suicide was a sin. And if you kill yourself, you're going to go to hell, basically.
Yeah.
That's kind of the Christian position. So
how do you think the fire started?
Everybody holds it.
How do you think the fire started, James?
Well, you know, Catherine Wessinger has done the best work on that. She has articles on this. She's at Loyola University.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's ambiguous because you do have hay bales and gas lanterns, and you're bumping into a frame building with tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that might have caused some combustion. There's also the possibility of these hot projectiles going in.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's some evidence that Koresh told his people that if they come in for us, we're going to take a stand and fight them off with fire, meaning there was some tapes about pouring oil outside the compound or the building and lighting it and that sort of thing. So it could have been a double kind of
right.
thing.
Did they think they would have been protected?
They did. Yeah, there's some passages about you will walk through fire
right.
and it will not hurt you. And, of course, everybody knows Daniel and the seven men in the fiery furnace.
Right.
Remember that and
right,
so
sure.
forth. So I think they kind of believe that, which most of us would consider a little bit delusionary.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
that was their faith, you know, that God would protect them. But I tell you, the real thing is they didn't think this was the end. But when the end comes is a kind of variable depending on how both parties behave. And once the gas is put in and the tanks come and they're basically tearing the building apart. They thought, well, I guess it is the end then,
right,
because, you know, it's over.
Yeah.
And we tried to give the message to the world, and it didn't work. So I don't share their view, of course. I'm not a Branch Davidian. I'm not
right.
I'm not a Branch Davidian sympathizer. I'm a human being sympathizer,
yeah,
meaning,
yeah,
I believe that it was handled in an unnecessary way. And I think the FBI has learned, because, you know, we've been meeting now for 25 years with the FBI.
Really?
At the American Academy of Religion meeting.
Very good.
They've completely revised their methods of dealing with religious groups. They
Great.
Talk now about making sure that, you know, that you consider their worldviews and so forth.
Yeah.
So I hope we won't have another Waco.
I'm glad to hear that you're doing that, James. Thanks so much. I've always appreciated your work.
Okay, it was great being
yeah.
with you.
All right, we'll talk again. Dr. James Tabor, Professor of Christian Origins and Ancient Judaism at University of North Carolina.